at 6 o'clock. That's the time context that's actually provided in the report. The problem is that there's no time context as to when Dr. Bismar actually became aware of any of the symptoms made the basis of the Moorhead complaint within that context. Dr. Oswalt complains that Lovenox, for example, was not discontinued. And in fact, he says earlier in his report, Lovenox was not discontinued until 2 a.m. on September 22nd. He then, a page or two later, says it was never discontinued. There's no way, looking at the contradictory statements in the report, that a trial court can make a determination of whether any of the physicians in this context did or did not comply with the standard of care with regard to discontinuing the Lovenox, because Dr. Oswalt's not clear as to whether it was discontinued or not. He suggests it was when he's reciting the facts of the case, but later suggests that it never was. And in the specific context of Dr. Mike Bismar, he doesn't provide any context as to when Dr. Bismar actually saw her, other than to say that Dr. Bismar saw her on the 22nd. So the first entry that he refers to is the 2 a.m. discontinuance of Lovenox, and the court is left to infer only one of two things, neither of which is negligence on the part of Dr. Mike Bismar. Either one, Dr. Bismar saw her at 2 a.m. and discontinued the Lovenox at that point in time, which meets his own standard as he sets it out, or two, it was already done by the time that Mike Bismar saw Ms. Moorhead on the 22nd, and therefore it didn't need to be discontinued at the time that Dr. Bismar was there. So based upon that particular allegation, there's no basis to conclude that there's merit to the claim against Dr. Mike Bismar. Second, there is a discussion of a need to transfuse her to address her hypovolemia. And he specifically references an order and a consent form obtained with regard to a transfusion because and at the behest of Dr. Mike Bismar. So the thing that he complains about, that there wasn't an order for transfusion, he specifically sets forth in his report that that was actually done. The problem is he doesn't say when it was done because it was an untimed progress note. And so the court can't infer that it was done, whether it was done early at the same time that the Lovenox was discontinued, or whether the Lovenox was discontinued by his brother Hisham, and then Dr. Mike saw her later in the afternoon and attempted to get the transfusion done later in the afternoon.
Why isn't that a causation question that would be addressed at the trial on the merits?
Well, because as the Supreme Court noted in Bowie Memorial, they still have to give an explanation for the causal relationship for any act or omission on the part of Dr. Mike Bismar and her, in this instance, her eventual demise. And you cannot conclude from this report that anything he did or did not do actually caused her death.
Let me tell you what I gather from this report, and you tell me why I shouldn't read it that way. That on September 21, nurses reported red bloody urine, increased swelling to the left arm. And there was no, at that time, according to this report, these were classic symptoms of hypovolemic shock. But we don't know who they reported to, but I read it, I would say that there's a reasonable inference that could be drawn from this, just an inference, that perhaps Dr. Bismar knew of this report on the 21st. I'm just saying that's a reasonable inference I think that could be drawn. And then the report goes on and says there was, in my word, however, no physician ordered to stop Lovenox until the afternoon of the next day. And it seems to me that what this report establishes is that at a minimum there needed to be a discontinuation of this medication on the 21st, and that the failure to do that was an alleged, you know, breach of the standard of care. And the only thing that arguably gets me to the point where I could say this might be a good faith attempt is the inference that I draw from the comments that on the 21st it was reported that she had these conditions. So,
First, Your Honor, the Supreme Court's made it clear you can't infer.
Can't infer anything. It's got to be right there. I thought there was a legal sufficiency standard that applied to these reports of some sort.
I would argue and have argued that there is a legal sufficiency. Whether or not there's more than a scintilla of evidence with regard to each one of those elements, I think is the test. Whether it's an abuse of discretion standard where the court is seeing whether the trial court applied the law correctly to the undisputed facts, which would be the report,
right,
or whether it's a de novo review, I think you still reach the same deal.
But if I'm applying just a pure legal sufficiency standard to this and determining whether there was an abuse of discretion, under the standard as I understand it, you can make an inference from facts. It doesn't have to be direct evidence. You could have circumstantial, and you can make inferences from circumstantial, and I would say this is kind of falls in that area.
I would respectfully disagree with the court. As I said, the Supreme Court in both the Boyd Memorial case and in the N. Ray McCallum case, and I believe we've cited and quoted both of them in our reply brief in that regard, have said that the court cannot infer, for example, in the McCallum case, the qualifications of a particular individual. The court has got to have actual facts with regard to this.
I would say that might be a little bit different, but go ahead. I'm sorry, Kes.
That's what the court says in this regard. Now, second, with regard to specifically the court's inference, I would say that's unreasonable because the court doesn't know from anywhere in this report when Mike Bismar actually saw this lady.
Is the inference when he saw her or when he learned of the problem? Because that could be two different things. He could have learned of this problem on the 21st but taken no action.
Well, I would argue that you do not have a duty to respond unless you are aware of the circumstances.
Well, I'm just saying that if the nurses reported bloody urine and increased swelling to the left arm, and if just taking, you know, this doctor's affidavit testimony is true, that these were classic symptoms of hypovolemic shock, that, again, I'm saying, you know, that's what I gather from this affidavit, that it's possible, based on that inference, that that Dr. Bismar knew of the condition and perhaps failed to do anything. But if you can't infer that kind of fact, you can't do it.
Your Honor, it doesn't say to whom they actually reported the results. The only mention of anybody being reported any results in the report is Dr. Hisham Bismar with regard to her initial admission. And I believe on the 22nd there was another report with regard to her condition, and that specifically is to Dr. Hisham as well. There's nothing in the report at all that says that Dr. Mike Bismar was in any way, shape, or form informed of any of these symptoms, and therefore the court can't infer that he failed to timely respond to these symptoms because the court doesn't know when he actually became aware of these particular symptoms. You are providing in your hypothetical the necessary information, which is that Mike Bismar was told about these symptoms on the 21st when the report itself says that he did not make an appearance in the record until the 22nd.
Well, that's true. But let's just assume for the purposes of this discussion that I'm right, that you can infer facts such as that from an affidavit such as this. Would you agree or disagree that would get the affidavit over the hurdle of good faith attempt?
That's a difficult question to answer, Your Honor, because the factual premise that you can infer a fact.
I know,
in that
I
regard,
understand.
If you can,
I'm saying,
Your
assuming
Honor,
I'm right, but I could be flat wrong. I'm just saying, assuming I'm right, what would you say,
Your Honor? If you can infer that Mike Bismar was told of these symptoms when they were reported on the evening of the 21st, and infer that he did nothing about them,
well, then I'm not trying to stack an inference. I'm just taking one inference is all I'm talking about, and that's the inference that Dr. Bismar knew or should have known, based on the report of the nurses, that there was a problem that needed to be addressed. I'm not taking it to the next level of inferring that he didn't show up. I mean, I think that's clear from the affidavit itself. You don't have to infer that. There's nothing here that says that he did show up and do anything on the 21st. So.
I will respectfully disagree with the court's hypothetical.
But if I were, well, I understand. I'm not asking you to agree to my hypothetical. I'm just asking if I'm right and you're wrong, what would you say in terms of the sufficiency of this affidavit?
I would still say that it is lacking from a causation standpoint.
Okay.
Because at that point in time, the court still has to determine in what there's no explanation here with regard to, because the court doesn't have, I mean, you can infer, but the court doesn't have an explanation of what happened and when and the responsiveness with regard to it. And so I still think you're having some difficulty with regard to that. With regard to the other two points, briefly, in their response, they suggest that Dr. Bismar should somehow be equitably refused an argument with regard to the lack of inference here because of the state of the record. That argument's been rejected by both the San Antonio and the Austin Courts of Appeals, as we pointed out in our reply brief, noting specifically that subsection S permits extensive discovery with regard to the health care involved, and that in this particular instance the record doesn't reflect that discovery was attempted under these circumstances. Finally, with regard to remand, because this was a report that was done in specific response to the single extension that was granted and permissible under subsection C, this is not an instance where if the court finds that the report is insufficient, that the court under Leland v. Brandel can remand back to the trial court for purposes of a determination of the 30-day extension.
In regard to what Judge Casey was asking, what do we do with the sentence in the report that says the records do show that both Dr. Hisham Bismar and Dr. Mike Bismar were caring for Gloria Moorhead within the critical 24 hours before her death? How do we factor that into the
Her death occurred at 6 o'clock. Dr. Bismar, so that would mean that it is a collective statement that both Drs. Bismar were caring for her in the 24 hours before that, which would be 6 o'clock the next morning. The report would be internally inconsistent, however, to find that Dr. Mike Bismar was actually caring for her on the 21st, because he says specifically that the first instance where he can find Dr. Bismar is on the 22nd, and he specifically uses the word thereafter when referencing any progress notes that he can attribute to Dr. Bismar after that. So based upon that, the only reasonable inference is that the only care that was provided by Dr. Mike Bismar was on the 22nd. So a collective statement that the brothers Bismar were caring for her 24 hours before her death would be accurate, even if Dr. Bismar, Mike Bismar, only cared for her on the 22nd. So I don't think you can assume or infer based upon that statement that he was caring for her from 6 o'clock on the 21st through her death. The record simply doesn't reflect that.
Thank you, Mr. Birdwell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Mayor.
May it please the court. In listening to the argument of the appellant, I think it's important to go over the timeline pertaining to the report, because I do think that the information is set out in chronological order as far as the notes that are arriving, and some of them are timed. All of them are dated. In 9/21/04, even though there's no incident report, there's an indication that she fell. This is in progress notes. And there's also a notation that she's not feeling very well, and there's an X-ray of her left arm showing soft tissue swelling. At that time, on 9/21/04, there's an ice pack ordered for hematoma of left forearm due to pain and swelling, and that's in quotes, and a sling is provided to elevate her arm. At 8:30 and 9 o'clock p.m. on the same date, September 21st, 2004, the nurses reported red, bloody urine, increased swelling to the left arm. Swelling increased from the size of a golf ball to the size of an orange. Then 9/22/04 at 2 o'clock a.m., there's a physician ordered to stop Levonex. It doesn't indicate any other thing but the time. Patient reported as bleeding heavily from left arm. 2 hours later, at 4 o'clock a.m., the catheter is continuing to draw bloody urine. The next note, and this isn't timed, it says patient examined by Bismar and noted extensive bleeding in left arm. This is Mike Bismar. Progressive notes attributed to Bismar, including an order for transfusion, there's no time noted, and it's not an emergency order. There's no stat applied to this order. As far as this is after the 4 o'clock a.m., the catheter drawing bloody, continuing to draw bloody urine. At 3:15, there is a 3:15 a.m., I think I got ahead of myself. This is the 4 o'clock a.m. came after this note. There's a 3:15 a.m. stat CBC ordered. Then there's the 4 o'clock order or 4 o'clock progressive note saying that the catheter is continuing to draw bloody urine. Then at 5:37 a.m., there's a second stat CBC ordered, and that's a diagnostic, a complete blood count. At 8:59 a.m., the results, the hemoglobin and the hematocrit are critically low. Then at 11:45 a.m., Gloria is hypotensive, according to the records. I think those were the computer-generated records. Sometime later, there's a Doppler arterial study ordered, and during the evaluation, the patient was suddenly found unresponsive, and that's at after 11:45 a.m. Blood and blood products were never administered to Gloria Moorhead, and she was transferred to the ICU. I don't think there's an indication of the exact time of the transfer, but there's an expiration summary, and at the time of her death was 6:15 p.m., a very large ecchymosis with hematoma in the left arm and a drop in the patient's hemoglobin. According to Dr. Bismar, the treating doctors did not feel that emergent treatment was necessary. And basically, even though there was an order more than 12 or 15 hours before before she was found unresponsive, or about 12 hours before she was found responsive, that Dr. Bismar ordered a transfusion, there was no administration of anything to control the bleeding, nothing no blood products or blood transfusion that was actually administered. And I believe that one of the comments that the appellant is saying as far as inferences, I believe when it's talking and Dr. Oswalt is quoting from the records where Dr. Bismar is examining the patient, this is after there's, as the Chief Justice pointed out, this is after there's indications of classic hypovolemic shock syndrome symptoms. Basically, he goes to examine the patient, and yet there's no you can't infer that or infer that a treating physician or examining physician in the hospital would be looking at the patient's chart. As he's examining her and making notations of this growing hematoma, as the fact that it's bleeding extensively, to me that's an indication that he saw the signs, but he did nothing about it. And that's what Dr. Oswald is saying. As far as the purpose of the report, I think it's been mentioned that this is not to prove, as you would in trial, as far as the negligence of the specific doctor, but it's to provide the standard of care to show that how the defendant should have provided care and how it was breached and how that breach resulted in the death. And I think Dr. Oswald's, I think it's a 3-page report, does that very thing in detail. As far as the reply brief, and I think the main thing that the appellant is commenting on is there's no temporal context, but if you go over the timeline as I have going through the report, it's in chronological order, and even though Dr. Bismar fails to place, as he's supposed to, the time of his evaluation and examination of Gloria Moorhead, the progress notes that come after that show approximately what time it was. And it's around, it looks like it's between 2 and 3 o'clock, it's between 2 and 3:15 a.m. On the 9/22, 2004. And obviously, no one's omniscient. Dr. Oswald or no other doctor would know whether or not Dorothy Moorhead would survive if it had been given at the time she was found unresponsive. But I think what Dr. Oswald is saying is that if bleeding was controlled, as soon as those symptoms were detected, which was long before, it was on the 21st of September, if those symptoms were recognized by the doctor, which they should have been, and if the protocol or the standard of care was followed as far as stopping the bleeding and then administering blood products and blood transfusion, then Dorothy Moorhead in reasonable medical probability, would not have passed away.
According to the appellant, however, there's nothing in the affidavit that indicates when the Dr. Bismar became aware of the problem until you get to September 22 when he examined her. And what I gather from this is that by that time it might have been too late. I mean, it looks like from the affidavit there might have been some negligence on the part of the nurses and perhaps not reporting immediately to the doctor. I'm taking the other side of my hypothetical now and playing devil's advocate with you, I guess, and asking you, where is it in this affidavit that you can look to tell anyone when Dr. Bismar became aware of the problem that the patient was having until before September 22?
Well, Dr. Bismar is admittedly a treating physician in the hospital, and when the nurse's notes indicate in 9/21/04, reporting for the doctors, and I think this can be inferred that the doctors put down their reports of what their observations are for the doctor when he comes around to review that, or immediately tells them about it, because they're saying red bloody urine, increased swelling to the left arm, swelling increased to the from the size of a golf ball to the size of an orange. It's obvious that there's something seriously wrong. The fact that Dr. Bismar examines her on 9/22/04 after the order to stop Levonix, and the patient is reported to be bleeding heavily from the left arm, I think in that period of time, there's a reasonable probability, and that's what I think Dr. Oswald is saying. If the Levonix is stopped, the bleeding is controlled, and transfusions are given, it was well over 12 hours later that she was found unresponsive. There was only a CBC that was ordered stat, not the transfusion. And so as far as what the doctor knew or should have known, I think that has to be inferred because this is a treating physician in the hospital setting, and these nurses are obviously putting down these notes to alert the doctor and to indicate that there's a problem.
But if it's improper to make that inference, as appellant says, then you lose, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think as far as making inferences, I don't know if you can keep from making inferences in any case where you're talking about an expert report, to be truthful, because you're not proving the case as you would before a jury. It's not, in support of a summary judgment. What you're doing is the standard of review is for whether or not the trial court abused its discretion by finding that this report was sufficient to show that there was a breach of a standard of care, and that breach resulted in the death of Gloria Moorhead. As far as I said, what needs to be proven, it's the standard of care, how the doctors did not follow the standard of care, and then what the results are. And this report does that, and that's what's required by the remedies code. So basically, Your Honors, I don't think that there could have been a more complete report, but also I don't think that the appellee should be faulted because Dr. Bismar didn't follow the administrative code and put down the dates and times of when he evaluated a patient or examined a patient. The only thing that was done was ice was ordered, a sling, and nothing as far as that would be critically important, as Dr. Oswald said, as far as controlling this hypovolemic shock, which ended up killing her.
Well, there is one way it could have been more complete, and that is, and I don't know whether this would have been true or not, the nurses reported to Dr. Bismar, et cetera, or Dr. Bismar learned of this on et cetera. But, you know, that's the only way I think it could have been more complete. I'm not necessarily saying that it's not sufficient under the good faith standard, but...
But I think, Your Honor, as far as given the condition of these records, I think that would be wonderful if they did say who they were reporting to and when they were reporting, but that did not happen. And so as far as I guess we were lucky to get the times that we did get in these records. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Mr. Birdwell.
May it please the court. Three quick points. First, this is not stated in the report, but counsel has represented to the court that all of the entries were dated. If that is true, then his statement that Dr. Bismar saw her on the 22nd and thereafter made progress notes would conclusively demonstrate that Dr. Bismar did not see her on the 21st. Second, she is arguing for the first time that this report sets out the care provided in chronological order so that the paragraph where Dr. Oswald specifically mentions Dr. Mike Bismar and specifically says that he does not have any times with regard to any of his progress notes now is being argued that that should be read that, in fact, Dr. Oswald is reciting the care in chronological form. That was not argued in the trial court. The court shouldn't permit that type of argument here, but nevertheless, it's also asking the court to infer something that Dr. Oswald himself did not actually say. And it's contradicted by what he actually said, which is, I don't have times. Third and finally, with regard to this argument that about concerning the inadequacy of the records here. Ms. Moorhead died in September of 2004. The suit was not filed until 2 years later in 2006. The Moreheads took their full 120 days to come up with a report, 120 days in which, according to subsection S, they had the opportunity to clarify the records with regard to times by sending to Dr. Mike Bismar depositions on written questions, specifically referencing the records as to where and what time did you make such, what entry did you make and what time you made such entry. Interrogatories with regard to, for example, the transfusion form. When was the transfusion form filled out? Requests for production, requests for admissions, and requests for disclosure. And in fact, in the initial hearing with regard to the original report, the complaint was made, this same complaint was made, about the lack of ability to discern from the medical records who was who, and a complaint was made about the discovery that had been conducted. And even at that point, the Moreheads did not request or any type of order compelling disclosure or to answer any type of discovery with regard to any of these matters, even though Judge Womack gave them an additional 30 days and no doubt would have ordered those disclosures within that period of time so that that information could have been provided for the supplemental report. So now coming up and saying that somehow, because the records are inadequate, the court should reasonably infer the time frame from the report, and then blaming it on Dr. Bismar, I think is incorrect. That inequity would be inappropriate, and we would so argue that for the court.
Well, excuse me, were any of the medical records attached to the expert report or the supplemental report?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, can we even go and look at those records?
According to the court's recent decision in the Collini case, which the court's aware I was counsel in that case, this court has decided that it cannot go outside the four corners of the document. We had argued in that case that its sister court in Beaumont, in a case called Carter, had in fact gone outside the record in that regard to determine whether or not the factual statements were correct within the report. The records were not offered in the trial court. They were not a part by any of the parties. They were not part of the record, and therefore we would suggest would be inappropriate, although I would love to suggest that we would love for the court to go outside the four corners of this particular report, but the court cannot, and so the court is so limited.
Okay. Thank you both, counselors, for your appearance here this morning and for your arguments. The case is submitted, and you're both excused. We'll take a 5-minute recess to make a panel substitution.
All right, this morning we only have one case on our 10:30 docket, Central Garden versus Vokes. You'll announce counsel, please.
Thank you.